many of you have ever experienced a situation where when somebody found out what your religious beliefs were, their attitude towards you changed? Has anybody ever had that happen? Okay, true story. First time I ever became totally aware that this was a real thing was in college at ECU. I was at ECU, and me and Jimmy... Is Jimmy not here? That may be a good thing. Then he cannot refute the story. Me and Jimmy and I think our good friend Les Everett, we had all gone downtown at ECU to enjoy some harmless fun, playing pool. We played some pool at Sports Pad, and then we went across to this place. Some of you will remember Bogies. Remember Bogies? Yeah. The fact that you remember Bogies does not surprise me. We may have hung out in there and didn't even know it. So this is a dance place for those of you who do not know that. And it was named after Humphrey Bogart, who had nothing to do with dancing, so I don't know why it's named after him. But we were in there, and I asked this girl to dance, and she seemed lonely enough that she would dance with me. So we were dancing, and we danced three or four times. Everything seemed to be going well, and we sat down, and we started talking, and she told me what her major was, and I told her I was working on my master's degree in history, and, you know, we had a wonderful chat. And then she said, and she told me she had a part-time job, and she said, "Do you have a job?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm a youth minister." Now, my first clue that this was not a good thing to tell her was that she immediately said, "Would you excuse me? I have to go to the restroom." Now, conveniently, the table that we were sitting at had a view of the bathroom door. And after about 7 minutes, when she didn't come out, it occurred to me, there's a window in there. And so this girl came out. I said, "Is there anybody else in there?" And she said, "No. No, I've been there a few minutes, and there's nobody else in there." She said, "But there was a girl." I said, "Who went out the window?" She said, "Yes." Now, if you've never had that happen, and by the way, I am to this day convinced that it was because I was a youth minister and not something else. That's my story, and I'm sticking with it, which is why it's good that Jimmy's not here so he can't refute it. And if he starts typing messages to the people who are working online today, block him. The reality is that we live in a world where not everybody is really interested in what our belief system is, and we are living in a world where it's becoming increasingly likely that you are going to be shunned or shamed or, as I think the current term is, canceled. You can be canceled by people if they do not like your views and your viewpoint. And I think we have become people that are so sensitive, we really worry about that and take it personally, and we really fret over whether or not people are going to react that way to us. And so I was thinking about this as I've seen so many things in recent weeks about cancel culture and all the negative things that get said if your beliefs do not line up with whatever the current trendy, loud people on social media are. And I think this coalesced last night when I found out they're renaming Mr. Potato Head. Which, because he can't be a mister, that's really the biggest problem in our country right now is how Mr. Potato Head is named. But, you know, that's the culture we live in. People just do not like certain things, and so they will go after you if you do not agree with them. And as Christians, we are becoming increasingly the minority in our viewpoints, even within the church. As we're seeing more and more churches that are kind of moving away from the Bible and moving towards acceptance. And that's becoming a common theme. And it's really problematic that we have so many churches that are like, we want to be accepting. And so we're going to accept this. And we're going to hide our views on this because we don't want to offend people. And that's kind of the world we live in. And so as I was thinking about all this, it occurred to me, you know, did Jesus really ever have to deal with this the way we do? And we always think about, you know, when Jesus was on this earth, yes, he had a lot of people that rejected, but he also had a lot of followers. And so how did that work with him? And then I came across this passage in Mark chapter 6. And that's going to be our text this morning, because to me, this is probably the best example of rejection Jesus ever dealt with, probably the most personal rejection he dealt with up until the day Peter denied him three times. Now, to set this story up, Jesus is going back to his hometown of Nazareth. And I want to make sure that before we get into the text, you understand specifically what this is. Nazareth is not a huge city. It's not Jerusalem. It is a relatively small place. Now, if any of you grew up in small towns, anybody grew up in small town? Small town people, you know how this is? You know everybody, and everybody knows you. They don't just know you, but they know your business. They know everything you do. Somehow it always gets back to your mom before you get home. That's a truth fact right there. There were times my mom knew what I had done while I was out before I did it. And that's the nature of small towns. So Nazareth is not a huge place. It's a relatively small town. And so this is where Jesus has grown up. Since when his family came back from Egypt, Jesus has grown up in Nazareth, hence Jesus of Nazareth, if you were wondering. So this is his hometown. So we're going to pick this up in verse 1 of Mark chapter 6. It says, Jesus went out from there and came into his hometown, and his disciples followed him. And when the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many listeners were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things, and what is the wisdom given to him, and such miracles as these performed by his hands? Now, it's important to note that visiting rabbis, if you would become a rabbi, or what essentially just means teacher, if you become a teacher and you had followers like Jesus did, it was not uncommon for visiting rabbis to be invited to teach or speak in the synagogue. And so they're in the synagogue, and so Jesus is kind of, this is his home synagogue. This is the synagogue he grew up going to. He had probably come here as a child to be taught, like all young Jewish boys were. And so this was very familiar territory to him. And so as he comes into the synagogue that day and he gets up to speak, it's not like most places where he would get up to speak and not know anybody. It is very likely that Jesus knew everybody in that room that day, or at the very least, most of them. We generally believe that Jesus stayed in Nazareth until just about the time he was 30. So Jesus has only been away from Nazareth at this point for probably a year, maybe a year and a half. And so he knows, as he's in this synagogue in Nazareth, he sees probably people who taught him as a child, his next door neighbors. He's probably got cousins in there and family. So these are all familiar people. And so Jesus, in the midst of these familiar people, gets up and he starts teaching. And it says, while the listeners were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things, and what is the wisdom given to him? Now, I don't know that there's an implication here that Jesus wasn't a smart kid, and that when he grew up, he wasn't very smart, and now everybody's shocked that all of a sudden Jesus is smart. I think more than likely, because Jesus was waiting to start his ministry, people had never really heard Jesus talk like this. He had kind of functioned as a carpenter's son and as a carpenter in his own right, and so everybody knew him. Now, have any of you ever stereotyped somebody or been stereotyped by somebody? If that's ever happened to you, you can understand Jesus' situation here. Jesus has walked into this synagogue, and to everybody in that room, what is Jesus? He's a carpenter. He is Bob the Builder. If any of you remember Bob the Builder, he's a carpenter. That's his thing. He builds things. He's not a scholar. He's not a prophet. He's not a rabbi. He's a carpenter. And that's all he's ever going to be to these people. Because once you've identified with a group of people something that you are, it's hard to change, right? even if you change. Any of you ever gone to a class reunion? And everybody just assumes that everybody at the class reunion is the exact same person they were when they graduated with that class? And look, trust me, as a minister who grew up in Eastern North Carolina, I get this nonsense a lot. I remember a minister who was more of my father's age group than mine saw me a couple years ago, and he says, I hear you're still at university. But when I hadn't even got to the punchline yet.
It was already shocked.
He was already shocked. He was like, I hear you're still at university. I said, yeah. He goes, you've been there a long time. I said, yeah. He goes, amazing. I said, why is it amazing? He goes, because I knew you when you were little. I said, yeah. And he said, never saw this. I said, I wasn't that bad. He goes, yeah, you kind of were. Well, that's only been 40 years ago. I mean, I'm 54 now. So, you know, I turned a teenager like 39 years ago. And he still sees me, which I guess in some ways is kind of nice, as a skinny teenager. Which is not actually that unappealing in some ways. But it's like, it's hard for people, once you get identified, it's hard for people to change their view of you. So Jesus is in this synagogue with all these people who have only known him as one thing. He's always been Jesus the carpenter. And because he was out without sin, probably the weird kid down the road, right? I mean, you picture a teenager that doesn't commit sin. Most of us look at that. That's a weird kid. That kid's a little odd. He's a little different. He's a little off. He's not like the other kids. And so Jesus has always been that person. And so now, all of a sudden, he comes back into Nazareth, and he's doing all this teaching, and the people, they don't know what to do with it. All right, verse 3. He says, is not this the carpenter? Now, there's an interesting little line that comes next, which if you're not paying attention, if you've never read this in a commentary, it might slip past you. It says, is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, and brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon, and are not his sisters here with us? Now, here's what's really interesting about that little phrase. In Hebrew culture, it was an insult to identify a son by the mother. It was a patriarchal society. And so in a patriarchal society, you identify when you are the son of so-and-so, it's always the father. You may have remembered Jesus referring to Simon, son of Jonah. James and John were the sons of Zebedee. You don't know their mother's name because in that culture, you identified a son by the father. So it says, is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary? Mama's boy. Mama's boy. Now, there's a couple of ways, and I read in multiple commentaries because I was really curious about this term. As I started to read, different commentaries have different assumptions, but none of them are good. Some kind of lean towards the idea that maybe people thought of him as a mama's boy, which is weird because he was a carpenter. He was trained by his father. Maybe they say this because his father had been dead a long time. We don't know what happened to Joseph or when, but we assume that from this story, Joseph is not on the scene at this time. We certainly know by the crucifixion he's gone, and it seems like he's gone here because he's not mentioned. Probably has passed away. Or this could be some sort of veiled reference back to the claim of the virgin birth. That maybe Mary has told someone that Jesus was the Son of God. Maybe she had shared that with somebody, and word had gotten out in the community that Jesus really wasn't the son of Joseph. And so we don't really know, but we do know from this statement that this is a derogatory term. This is kind of a shot at Jesus as not being the son of Joseph. We're going to call him the son of Mary. This is a negative statement. So it says, is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary? And we know who this guy is. We know who he is. We know his brothers, James and Joseph and Judas and Simon. We know his family. His sisters are here. They're all here. We know who this guy is. We know who he is. Now, if you've ever had someone identify you that way, and you're like, well, I've changed. You know, one of the fundamental concepts of Christianity is when you become a Christian, what's supposed to happen? It's supposed to change, right? A new creation, a new creature, that's what's supposed to happen. We're supposed to be this new creation. And so here's Jesus, and he's come in, and he's teaching in a way they've never seen, and they've never heard him do this before, and they're kind of shocked by it. And they're like, well, who is this guy? We know who he is. He grew up here, but we know who his family is. We don't understand any of this. And so you notice that when he changes and he begins to function differently, they turn on him. They don't look at him and go, oh, wow, this fine, look at what a fine young man he's turned into. Look at what a fantastic teacher he's become. What a, man, this is fantastic. It's not what they do. And I cannot emphasize enough that for Jesus, how personal this would be, because these are people that he's known since his childhood. These are people who have watched him grow up. They're neighbors. They're people. He's probably built stuff for some of these people as a carpenter. He's done work for them. He has a personal relationship. It's not like when he goes into some village that nobody really knows him personally. I mean, they've heard of the prophet. They've heard his name, but they don't know him. It's not personal relationships. These are people that he personally knows, that he's grown up with. That, I mean, some of the guys in this synagogue are probably guys who went to class with him. They were his contemporaries. Some of them may have been his friends. And in this moment, Jesus faces probably the most significant rejection of his life up until this moment. These people who have known him, who have watched him grow up, who have had relationship with him as, in some cases, family, neighbors, business relationships, friendships, in this moment, they turn on him. Now, here's the question. Why? Why do they turn on him? They're amazed at his teaching. What he's saying isn't the problem. His message is not corrupt. They don't take issue with the message. So why do they turn on him? Because he's the wrong guy to give the message. We're not accepting this from him. We know this guy. We know what a weird kid he was. We're not listening to this from them. And you see this at the end of this verse. So it says, we know his brothers, his sisters are with us. And it says, they took offense at him. They were offended. Not at his message, not about his miracles. They're offended that it's him. Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and among his own relatives and his own household. Now, I want to pose a question to you this morning. This is a personal question. It's not a question for me to answer. It's not really even a question for the people around you to answer. This is a question for you. How many times have you resisted the temptation to share your faith with somebody, not because you thought they would reject your message, but because that you thought they would reject you? That the rejection becomes personal. I don't want to hear that from you. You don't have the right to say that to me. We used to do stuff together. You know the stuff we used to do. You're in no position to lecture me on faith. I know what you really are. You ever been afraid of hearing that? Guys, I'll be honest with you. Every Sunday when I get up to preach, my greatest fear is that people from my past will wander in and sit down. Now, you laugh because you think I'm joking. I'm not joking. I'm not afraid of a lot on stage. I've been doing this long enough. If I make a mistake, it really doesn't embarrass me. If somebody starts snoring while I'm preaching, I just talk louder than they are. I mean, there's not a lot that bugs me up here because I've been doing this long enough. I don't really get embarrassed very easy. If I tripped and fell down, I'd get up and laugh about it because that's all you can do. But I do fear those some of those people coming and going. You are really in no position to tell anybody about Jesus, because, dude, we used to hang out back in the day. Any of you got some of those friends around? You're like, oh, yeah, I remember those people. We sometimes find ourselves trying to live a double life, not because we're afraid that people are going to reject our faith, because really, that's up to them, right? It's their eternity. I mean, Jesus said, look, all you can do is share the message. You can lead the horse to water, but you can't make him drink. I don't think it's fear of the rejection of the message that we live with. It's fear of rejection of us. And that's exactly what's happening to Jesus here. They're not rejecting his message. They don't take issue with anything he says from a theological standpoint. They're offended because it's him. And I think we can relate to that, especially in the culture we live in today, where if we dare to speak out against some social issue that is not a popular stance, people may come after us. That's the double-edged sword of being on Facebook Live, right? On being able to broadcast your sermons on the internet. Anywhere somebody, and so now it's like, wow, Stuart, what would happen if you got up and did a sermon and you addressed homosexuality and you didn't address it in a positive way? Do you realize that a couple of weeks ago, one of the most prominent Christian writers in this country was invited to speak at a church that was pro-homosexual, and he had to apologize for his previous writings about homosexuality to be allowed to speak at that church? And I'm not talking about some scrub guy you've never heard of. This is probably something, a lot of you probably have books of his on your shelf. But that's the culture we live in. If you speak out against something that we think is wrong, you know, we've embraced this now, and if you don't embrace it, we're going to cancel you, buddy. We're coming after you. We're going to shut you down. We're going to attack you personally. That is the world you live in now. You may not like it. You may not acknowledge it. Maybe you don't know it, but that is the world that you live in now. And for you guys who live and breathe social media, who are so young and you're so tied to it, look, some of these older people are going, I still don't know how to use the Facebook. I still don't know, I'm not sure how that thing works. They don't care. They're like, what are they going to do, cancel me? I'm 80 years old. Cancel me. But for you guys, your generation, where everything you think and everything that comes to mind is out there on social media, How are you going to manage your faith in that world? This is a real dilemma, and it's not new. We see Jesus deal with this. And again, it's not even always about the message. A lot of times it's just about the messenger. You don't lecture me. You're not allowed to have an opinion. You're not allowed to have a viewpoint. I know you. Jesus said a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown. And this next line, this hurts. Among his own relatives and in his own household. Some of the people in that room that were taking offense at him, it sounds like, were family. When I think back about the life of Jesus and I think about the times he's rejected, I'll be honest with you, this to me is the most personal one. When he goes to his hometown. And by the way, why is he in his hometown? Why does he go there? Well, why did Jesus go anywhere to preach? He's trying to tell these people about the kingdom of God. He's trying to tell them, look, this new covenant is coming. This new thing is coming. I'm ushering in something new. It's going to be awesome. And where do you think would be the most exciting place to do that? Home. Everywhere else I'm preaching to strangers, but here, man, I'm preaching to my family and my friends. I'm trying to save the people who have been close to me since I was a child. And they're not having it. They're not interested in what he has to say. This next line is one of the most difficult, and I can tell you, Jim and I and the ministers, we have lunch on Tuesdays, we've discussed this verse before because this is a really complicated verse. Verse 5 says, and he could do no miracles there except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And it says he wondered, in some translations it says marveled at their unbelief. Now, one of the things you see consistently in Scripture is that when Jesus heals somebody, he'll use this terminology a lot. He'll say, your faith has made you whole. You've read Jesus say that before, right? Most of you have probably read that in the Bible. Jesus says that your faith has made you whole. You might remember the centurion. He says, I've not seen so great faith in all of Israel. He says it to the leper, the Syrophoenician woman, which we'll be talking about her in a few weeks. There's numerous cases where Jesus identified. We even just talked about one a few weeks ago. The woman who came and grabbed his cloak so that she would be healed. And he marveled at her faith. And now, it says Jesus is in Nazareth. Now, you could pick this verse apart and you can try to get, and I'm a big believer, sometimes the simplest way to interpret a verse is just to take it for what it says. It says he could do no miracles there except a few. Now, people don't like that verse because Jesus was omnipotent, he was all powerful, so he could do whatever he wanted to. But we know that frequently his miracles seem to be linked to faith. So is this a verse saying that Jesus physically couldn't do miracles or that he chose not to? Or maybe how about this? These people had so little faith in him, they wouldn't even come to him for healing. How about that? I got leprosy. There's a healer in town. Who is it? Jesus, the carpenter? The weird kid down the road? Joseph's son? That kid? Yeah, I'm not going to him. But dude, you got leprosy, you got nothing to lose. I'm not going to him. That kid was weird. I'm not going. Can you imagine that? That the people in this city have so unanimously rejected their son. And this is a hometown. This is a hometown kid. And they have so unanimously rejected him that sick people in Nazareth won't even come to him for the chance of healing. They'd rather stay home and be sick. And now you stop and you go, okay. Why did Jesus go there? I mean, to be certain, Jesus knew that was going to happen, right? I mean, because he's Jesus. He knows stuff. So why does Jesus go to Nazareth if he knows it's going to make these people reject him? Why would he go? And I think it's a lesson for us. You have this message. And there are some incredible, fantastic, wonderful things that come with being the holder of that kind of knowledge and that kind of gift. But with that responsibility comes burden. I don't know if any of you remember, there used to be this really cool commercial. It was a Gatorade commercial. And I'm not generally a fan of Michael Jordan and Michael Jordan commercials, but I really like this one because it highlighted how many game-winning shots he missed. Any of you remember that commercial? And Jordan talked about how many times he's taken game-winning shots and missed. And one of the things he said in an interview about that commercial one time, he said, one of the problems with taking a game-winning shot is if you hit it, you're the hero. But if you miss it, I think about the life, because I'm more of a football guy than a basketball guy, I think of the life of a field goal kicker. You're down 1 point, you trot out on the field. You know how important field goal kickers are? Do you know that most people in the world consider Tom Brady the greatest quarterback in NFL history? Did you guys know that? You may not agree with it, but that's how most people consider him. Do you know that of his, how many Super Bowls has he won now? Seven? Of his seven Super Bowls, do you know that I think four of those were won by the kicker? Did you know that? Kicker beat the Panthers. I do remember that. Kicker beat the Rams. I think I remember that. In fact, they wouldn't even have been in his first Super Bowl except the kicker hit a field goal in the snow against the Raiders after that stupid fumble call that wasn't a fumble. Or it was a fumble. They said it wasn't. But you know what? If it wasn't for Adam Vinatieri, Tom Brady's not the greatest quarterback ever. If it's not for Adam Vinatieri, Tom Brady's got more Super Bowl losses than any other quarterback in history. That's who he is if it's not for Adam Vinatieri. The kicker matters. And the kicker, when he trots out on the field down 1 point with the game on the line, is walking off the field one of two ways. He's either the rock star hero that everybody loves, or he's on suicide watch. That's the life of a kicker. You know, sometimes you're the hero, sometimes you're not. Well, that's your life as a Christian. When you have this incredible gift and you have this knowledge and you share it with people, one of two things is going to happen. That they're either going to accept it, it's going to change their life, and they're going to love you forever for the impact you made in their life. And I would guess most of you in here who are Christians can probably right now, if you closed your eyes, think back to a person who was instrumental in you becoming a Christian. Maybe it was a minister, maybe it was a youth minister, maybe it was a parent, maybe it was a counselor at camp. I don't know. Could be any number of people. Could maybe have been a school teacher back in the day. But you can all probably think back to some person who was instrumental in you becoming a Christian. And here's really a great question today. Is there anybody in the world right now, if they close their eyes, would think of you like that? Boy, that's something to aspire to, isn't it? To think that somewhere right now, if somebody was asked this question in a different church service somewhere else, they would close their eyes and they would picture your face. Oh, my camp counselor. Oh, my gosh. Changed my life forever. Oh, this person I went to school with, this person who was not afraid to share their faith, they didn't care what everybody else thought. Man, changed my life forever. I had a lot of friends in Bible college who came from really messed up backgrounds, and they would all be able to tell you, this person who changed my life forever. But in every one of those cases, the opportunity for rejection was there. And so I think Jesus went to Nazareth for one specific purpose. I think, knowing that those people would reject him, he went as a lesson for us. That if you are going to bear my name, if you are going to carry my salvation, then you need to be prepared to be rejected for my name's sake. Scripture tells us that repeatedly, right? I mean, that's not like a one-hit thing in Scripture. The Scripture tells us that repeatedly. This is what you must be willing to endure if you're going to be mine and you're going to share my witness. Look, I wish we lived in a different time, I guess. You say that and then you go, well, what time would you want to live? The 80s are pretty awesome, I'm not going to lie. The 80s are pretty good. I mean, compact disc and Ronald Reagan, what more could you want? Those were good times. Those were good times. Hair bands. That whole hair bands. You didn't like hair bands? Kaylee, you okay? I said hair. Oh, I had hair. Yeah. That was a good time too, Ryan. Thanks a lot for mentioning that, bud. Is that Kaylee? Kaylee said it. Ken said it. It drifted somewhere from the back. That's okay. That's okay. I'm going to have a mane in heaven. I'm going to be really disappointed if I get to heaven and everybody's bald. I'm going to be so sad. I'll be like, oh, I thought I was getting long hair again. That would be fantastic. But the reality is that this is the time we live. And we can't change that. And we can't change the climate of the world. It is what it is. And Satan has created this climate on purpose because he's tried everything else he can to squelch the good news, and nothing's worked. And so now this is the new thing. I'm going to get you to be so afraid of public opinion. I'm going to make you so afraid of what other people say about your belief system that I'm going to shame you into silence. Now, is that going to work? That's a good question, isn't it? It's already worked in some places. It's worked on some churches, and some churches have just caved. They've just said, hey, look, we'll accept whatever. We don't want anybody mad at us. We're going to teach whatever makes everybody happy. That, you know, that's fantastic. But you know what? That's not how the gospel's supposed to work. Truth still matters. Truth still matters. The love of God is an important message, and it needs to be shared. And if we don't share it, who does? Mark doesn't give a lot of detail about Jesus' exodus from Nazareth. Luke gives more detail. They're going to try to throw him off a cliff. And so Jesus left Nazareth that day, and I want you, as we get ready to close, and as the praise team comes to lead us in our communion hymn, I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to try to feel what Jesus felt the day he walked out of Nazareth, having been rejected by his family, having been rejected by his closest friends, having been rejected by the spiritual leaders that taught him, having been rejected by all these people who had watched him grow up, these people he had called family and friends. And I want you to imagine how he felt leaving Nazareth that day. Now, here is the truth. I think Jesus left sadder at their rejection of his message than he was sad at the rejection of him. Because Jesus knew he was going to be rejected. He came to be rejected. He knew that the rejection of his message was eternal. And so today, I want to challenge you to do something that is really counterintuitive. I want you to embrace the ability to be rejected, because it is part of who you are. When you become a Christian, rejection becomes part of your DNA, because Jesus told us, Paul told us, Peter told us, John told us, Stephen showed us that when you become his, the world will reject you But the Father never will.